Hello, folks, and welcome to another episode of On My Mind. I'm Shelley Griffith, and I'm very delighted today to have with me the General Director and CEO of Knoxville, Tennessee Opera Company, Jason Hardy. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
We're tickled to have you. And start out, if you will, Jason, as I do with my guests. Tell us about some of your background, where you were born, raised, and the family.
I was born in the Panhandle of Florida, so I grew up, and most of my family is still there. Oftentimes when I even talk about them or begin the drive home, my accent starts to come in, but you don't often hear it anymore. But yeah, I grew up in North Florida and went off to college, studied at Emory University in Atlanta, did my undergrad there. Eventually, after a couple of years in between figured out what I wanted to do, I ended up going into the singing path and went to the Peabody Conservatory in Baltimore, Johns Hopkins. And from there, yeah, it was, I got my master's degree and did an artist diploma there. And from there, I was, took on management, became opera singer on the road, if you will, and did that for about 18 or so years, based in Atlanta at that time. And yeah, and then got into arts admin. I made that pivot about a little over 10 years ago now. And it's brought me eventually here to Knoxville.
What drew you from singing into administrative work, though?
I guess if I tell, that was the Cliff's Notes version of the story. I grew up on my parents' farm, right? So my grandparents owned a farm in the Panhandle, and that's where I spent my summers working, pulling produce and going to farmers markets, et cetera. And so working in the fields, it was in that hot North Florida, humid, that hot environment that I decided that I wanted to pursue a life and a career that involved working in air conditioning. So I didn't have, those were my aspirations. No, in all seriousness, I thought I wanted to be a businessman. I wanted to be in New York. I wanted to work on Wall Street. I wanted to be in a high-paced environment. I wanted to be a hotshot executive, investment banker sort of thing. So I actually went off to Emory to study business. So when I passed on my full scholarship to Florida State to study music, because I was a pretty decent band kid back in the day, but I thought, I'm going to put the music aside. I'm going to start thinking about my career now. And I'll never forget the day, because I was studying in the undergrad business program at Emory. And when I arrived, I joined the university chorus as a musical outlet, because I did enjoy music a lot. And one thing led to another with a couple of my first couple of years in college that I made the fateful call one day to my parents and said, Mom, could you put Dad on the phone? Okay. And they're on the phone. I said, I've decided I want to pursue a career singing opera. And after a long, deafening silence, my dad said, Son, how are you going to make any money? And I said, fair question. Fair enough. So there we go. So that started the whole path to my career in opera.
Isn't that amazing, Jason, how many folks you've known and I've known who talk about singing, being a painter, doing something else, and the first reaction from our parents is, how you gonna make any money?
That's right.
I don't understand that. But so as you began to work your way into this administrative role, you were in Atlanta first?
Yes.
Okay. And then went from Atlanta
to Baltimore.
To Baltimore. That's
where I studied graduate
school. Okay. Yeah. And got that. And do you, or did you play, or do you play instruments as well?
So I did. I don't anymore, other than when I was a singer, I'd pluck notes out on a piano. I wouldn't say I was a pianist by any stretch. But yeah, I really gave up the instrumental life. I was a band kid, so I played all the brass instruments. So from anywhere from trombone, euphonium, those were my two main instruments. And so, of course, I could read music, and I knew music theory and all that. So I didn't have to play any sort of catch-up. I mean, there are a lot of singers that don't have that background. They can't read music. They may have lovely voices, but that sort of backfilling didn't have to happen with me because I had a pretty strong background in music. And singing was always a passion of mine, but my voice changed late. I never had much of a singing voice. And even when I went to college and auditioned for the university chorus my freshman year, I didn't have a very large range, so that they put me in the bass section. And it's funny, after a semester of that, there was this hot shot. He was a junior at the time that I sat beside, and he was this handsome guy who was dating the most pretty girl in the chorus and all that. And I was like, oh man, this guy's so cool. And he leans over to me one day and says, you have a very nice singing voice. You should take lessons. And I thought, coming from him, I'm going to say whatever he says. So Emory has it's a liberal arts college, yeah. And it's got, what's great about that is you get such a wide variety of disciplines that you study just as part as your undergraduate work. So I thought, sure, I'll see what that looks like because it sounds like fun. And it turns out you could be a double major. You could get voice lessons with your major. So it didn't conflict with my business studies. So I became a double major. And that's where things begin to shift because got on with this teacher very well, and one opportunity led to another where I just made progress really quickly, and enough people in the Atlanta area I had sung for, and just one opportunity presented itself and thought, you have a shot at this if you really wanted to give this a go. And I'd never even seen an opera until my sophomore year in college. I went to see an opera, and it was at that moment that I probably should have realized at some point I was going to be an administrator, because I got my student rush ticket, and I'm sitting there in the audience in Atlanta at the Fox Theater in Atlanta, and seeing this production of Turandot, which is a big scale production. And I looked at the price of my ticket, knowing, all right, this is a cheap student ticket, but I know the top tickets were probably $100 or something at that time. And I thought to myself, let's see, there are probably about 2,000 people in this audience. And I'm looking at an orchestra of dozens of people. There may have been 60 people in that orchestra pit. I'm looking at all the principal artists on stage and all the chorus members and supers and their costumes and makeup and wigs and lighting. And I just, and looked around at the theater, this beautiful space, and I thought, how do these tickets pay for what I'm seeing right now? And the answer is that I was to learn later that it doesn't. It's so highly reliant upon philanthropy. But it was an extraordinary, it was one of those life-changing sort of moments where I didn't imagine myself on that stage. In fact, it was the furthest thing from it. It was so extraordinary, the fact that these voices are projecting over an orchestra of that size without amplification. Mm-hmm. And I was certainly not in that world yet. It showed me what this extraordinary art form was, but never imagined that years later I would be on the stage myself doing this as a career. So lots of exposures that way that sort of put me in that direction.
And you're... don't want to sound crazy, but your vocal range, though, at that time was...
Yeah, so I was a bass. I was a young bass. Okay. And the most dramatic thing happens when, obviously, the male voice changes. The lower it is, it's just the more extreme it is. You got how many days did I answer the phone and my voice would crack and whatnot. And I sounded like my mom one day, and then 2 days later, I had this crackly young bass voice. So it just takes time with a young bass voice to develop. So that the other benefit of the timing of all this was there was no urgency to get a career going, because young bass, it just takes time to develop. So you just need to be able to buy yourself enough time and do the right work. And if you're good, there's a higher chance you might have a chance of having a career, simply because the numbers, there aren't as many basses out there as there are, say, baritones or sopranos. So that was actually worked in my favor to some degree, is that I was not late to the game. Whereas as an instrumentalist, certainly, if I was a violinist or pianist, whatever, I mean, if you're not a prodigy by 10 years old, practically, I mean, your shot of doing concert piano work or anything like that. But as singers, we have to wait for our voices to develop. So that training could only begin as a young adult.
And do you get a chance now? We're certainly going to get into your administrative role, but do you get a chance now to maybe sing for fun or rehearse with anybody?
I do. On occasion, I'll pull out something that I can get through pretty easily. I haven't kept up with my practice in the last 10 years, but I do have a couple of kids and a wife who actually is also we call ourselves recovering opera singers. So we actually met as singers. But no, we don't get around to it as much. It's one of the things here in Knoxville that we'd like to, as we settle in, to just get involved in being in a choir, involved in the church, even though it's a far cry from the work I used to do. Just being able to sit in community with people and make music together is a very beautiful thing. And that's actually how I started. It started singing in a choir at Emory that exposed me to a world I had never been exposed to. And it's a beautiful thing.
Hopefully, like you say, as you're settling in continuously, that you can do more of that for the enjoyment of it.
Absolutely.
Know? For those of us who were in, and my listeners know, in medical school, you don't do any of that at all. And then many years later, as I got into practice, enjoying picking up a couple of instruments, just a community, as you say, of people performing. And so it's fascinating. But now take us, Jason, from the time you've come here to Knoxville and carry us into this moment about the administrative duties that you have. Take us through a day in your life coming in and how you begin promoting Knoxville Opera and the entity itself.
Yeah. Yeah, there are so many ways to answer that question, but I'll particularly in the context of coming out of COVID, I took this job, I was offered the job right at the beginning of the pandemic. And I was in Memphis at the time working there. And the thought of moving my family, my wife and two kids and our dog to a town when nobody was having in-person meetings or anything. So I decided to counter-propose and said, well, why don't we give it some time, see what happens. I'll work for you part-time, which I put in air quotes because I don't know how to do part-time. I kept my job, my full-time job in Memphis, and then took on this quote-unquote part-time gig here. But of course, it was, Knoxville has lived in a bubble for a long time. In a sense, it was like the best-kept secret. Since I've moved here, everybody talks about, oh, we were the best-kept secret. It is the best-kept secret. And the secret's now getting out because so many people are flocking and moving here. But before that, the cost of living was so low. Of course, it's always been beautiful with all the natural beauty that is around us. And the university's here. You've got all these arts and culture institutions that are these quiet, wonderful gems. So there's so much that it offers here. But being in this sort of bubble, artistically and whatnot, there were just enough people that just appreciated everything that was here that it had a pretty steady stream of support, relatively speaking. But what if you look at trends over the past, say, decade prior to the pandemic, you did see declining numbers in certain areas. Subscription sales were falling and even single tickets. And so there were a lot of trends that were not showing growth. And the audience was getting older. And as you're looking at trying to fill that pipeline of future audience members, I don't know that we were doing a good job as an organization filling that. But those who enjoyed the art form in its very basic traditional presentation sense, there are a lot of very satisfied opera and arts lovers here that enjoyed the experience of it. So with the pandemic, obviously everything, it accelerated change for everything and everyone and technology. You saw the acceleration of AI, for instance, of all of these things, whether it's Zoom and everything else, where before that you had Skype and you had some video chats on your phone and all that, but it just to a completely different level, how we began convening meetings or how we took in arts and culture experiences. And there's so many parts of this story that are so important to tell because in the height of that crisis, when we were all so isolated and scared, it's become such a divisive issue just talking about vaccines and masks and all that. But if you really think back to the very beginning, we were all scared. And what did we do? In that sense of isolation, we craved connection in so many ways, but we turned to our artists at that time, whether it was streaming films, whatever. In Memphis, we were doing performances on street corners and open parks and all that, just to give people some sense of community and normalcy and beauty in what was a very tough, challenging time. So I say all this to say the people's expectation and idea of what a shared experience is, or even what an arts and culture experience is, have shifted in some ways. And yeah, so you come through the pandemic and people, the way they consumed art, the way they had meetings, the way they even ordered their food or bought groceries or cooked, just everything was reevaluated and technology accelerated. So to go back to the previous model of presenting or even marketing is, you really have had, as a company to be viable long-term now, you've just got to revisit, reimagine your business model altogether. Knoxville being, like I said, in that bubble, that resistance to change that often happens when you've got a good thing and you want to keep that good thing. The benefit in some ways is that when everything was so disrupted, it gave in some ways permission to try some new things. So my first year when we were emerging from the pandemic, certainly the audiences had not fully returned, but new, younger people were coming out to these experiences. We saw this great dynamic sort of shift in the consumer for what we were doing, which helped us early on get numbers into the house when our older patrons were still not they were still afraid, still to convene elbow to elbow with 1,500 of their neighbors. So we actually started with a contemporary opera, my first season in charge, and it was called Glory Denied. It was in tandem with the Medal of Honor convention that was here. So we had all these Medal of Honor people come to town, I mean, these recipients, and it was just an incredible experience for Knoxville to host this event. And fortunately, I early on in my time here got connected with several people in the military community and said there's the show that would be very effective during this. And so we presented this piece called Glory Denied. And it's a hard contemporary opera that tells the story of the longest held prisoner of war in American history. And this gentleman was held in Vietnam for over 8 years. And so it's a very powerful story and a hard story. And so long story short, Knoxville Opera had never presented an opera like this because it was not in the traditional canon. And some people came, some people left at intermission. Many people were, you know, so responsive in a positive way. But the beautiful thing was, is it engaged in conversation. So very few people, even those that left at intermission, would say, it was a harder story than I'm used to, or the music was a little too dissonant for me, or whatever. But they still came, and they still cared enough to send a message to me about it as well. Because what we will learn as we evolve as a company is we're developing product lines that may not appeal to everybody. Mm-hmm. I also often make the analogy with movies. If I say I don't like movies because I saw one movie in my lifetime and it was a sci-fi flick and I turned out I don't like sci-fi, or it's a Woody Allen film, and if that's your only experience to it, then I just don't like movies is your blanket statement. But some movies draw you more than others. The same can be said of this and any other art form. Some love Mozart operas, and some prefer Wagner operas. Some prefer high death count operas that are very tragic and sad. Others prefer the comedies or the light operas. So it just, there's really something for everybody. And us exploring as a company these expanded product lines is the basis, really, for the changes we're doing. The nuts and bolts of marketing and all that stuff comes too, but it's about what stories are we telling and expanding those stories and bringing stories that haven't necessarily been told on the Knoxville Opera stages in the past are a part, not a major part yet, but certainly are a part of the overall offerings that we're putting together. And we're building some traction because it also, I think, affects people's willingness to try out the traditional stuff if their gateway into this was this new contemporary experience or a smaller, more intimate, site-based, you know, performance that we did that wasn't necessarily a full opera, but just invites them into an experience with us. And all that stuff has been joins into the experience that you get to see at the Tennessee, for instance, when you come to our show.
For our listening audience, and Jason knows, when we came recently to their latest production, make sure I'm pronouncing it correctly, La Traviata.
La Traviata, yes.
Is that close?
Yep, very good.
Thank you. Just thoroughly enjoyed this. Just a marvelous performance. And Jason had introduced things in his role, but just fascinating for me to become a newer fan, as you're talking about, because I'd never seen one, so now I'm hooked, to be honest with you. Can't wait till your next opera. In an average year, are you targeting, or how many operas would you like to perform in an average year if funding is there? Is that a proper question?
Sure, it absolutely is. Funding determines so much of it. I think for a company of our size, in a regional setting such as Knoxville, ideally, if we're doing 3 to 4 operas a year, and I say 3 to 4, meaning probably 2 to 3 of those would be the big scale things that people are used to, that they imagine it being, like what you saw La Traviata at the Tennessee Theater on a big stage with beautiful sets and costumes, while also mixing in 1 or 2 shows that are chamber scaled or variety, more intimate, you can tell. Yeah, so they could be contemporary shows, they could be early Baroque shows, things from centuries old that can be interesting pieces to do to stretch your artistic muscle. Yeah, funding does inform a lot of those decisions for sure.
And Jason, basically, how many folks are considered members then, if you will, of Knoxville Opera Company?
Yeah, so it depends how you define that, because that's something that I've had a lot of conversations with, because there are many folks who subscribe to an opera company. So they buy their subscription and their annual subscription. So no matter how many shows we have, and that's just the opera, as I said, we do performances throughout the season. We pretty much have something going on every day of the year. We're performing, we've got a something every week that we're not, where we have a Knoxville Opera Gospel Choir, we have a children's choir, our opera chorus does concerts, we're doing community events, performances. We just did a children's tour through schools of a short show. There's a lot that goes on here. And anybody who's investing that in that as a donor, as a patron, as a subscriber, in many ways, they all consider themselves members. We do actually have a membership campaign that we do annually, and it's basically an entry-level donation. It's a $50 or $100, depending if you're an individual or household, membership, which is basically just a low-level annual fund gift that says, hey, I support what you do. I want to be part of what you do. I want to be part of a community of folks that support the arts here in Knoxville. And for that, they will also, they get first access to ticket purchases. We do a couple events a year that is a membership gathering. So it's a no-cost event. So basically, the cost of their membership can cover the cost of food and beverage at some of these events we do. So we have a membership party at the beginning of the year, usually hosted by at someone's home or something that's lovely. That's just a nice way to meet people. And we introduce some singers to them. And it's a lovely casual affair. We're doing something just this week that's in alignment with the Final Four of college basketball. We've had this sort of online poll where we're getting people to vote on their favorite operas. And we have a Final Four, and everybody's coming to see the revelation of the final two of the Final Four. And then we'll sing selections from those operas and have a nice... So just fun ways to play on that ability. So any sort of social function to get our people together. Just ways to build community through the music that we do.
That's awesome. Now, we are aware that coming up within the next week or so, in pronunciation, the Rossini. Explain to our listeners what that is about.
Okay, the Rossini Festival is Rossini. That's the last name of a famous composer of Italian descent back in the day who... So I was saying we're 22 or so years ago when they started this annual festival here in Knoxville. They started in downtown Knoxville before they'd really redeveloped downtown. It's a very different area than it is now. But the idea was to start a little Italian festival downtown, and that there would be the same weekend that Knoxville was producing an opera. So we'd be driving traffic to downtown for this little street fair, and then they could see the opera that night. And then UT Opera was also presenting something that weekend. So you had this sort of extravaganza of opera going on in downtown. It was a way to activate that space downtown and Market Square and the surrounding blocks. And really, it was one of the first big things to drive people into downtown after a period of time when there was nothing, there were boards on windows and nobody was really down here. It was a ghost town from what I hear. And this was the start. It got to the point where at its peak, it was bringing over 100,000 people, I hear, to downtown, and it just exploded into more of an international street fair because there weren't enough Italian vendors to sustain something that large. So it just grew and grew and grew out of hand even, but it just became this the largest one-day festival the city has had, and it's gone on and evolved over the years. But yeah, we'll have that later this month. Here we are in April, on the 20th and 21st of April, and it's at some point, generally in April, every year that we have it, this is the first year we're doing a two-day festival. We're able to curate a better vendor experience by having a second day because we can draw more international vendors that are more interested in a two-day festival than a one-day festival because they're on the circuit trying to figure out where to go next. So we have four stages. There's music. We celebrate local art and culture experiences. So we have everything from high school choirs to barbershop quartets to dance troupes to opera, of course, and performances from the UT. It's a celebration of our local arts community here and performing community, and four stages going on all day for 2 days, nonstop, and food vendors and jumpy houses for the kids. And so it's just this wonderful opportunity for our neighbors from all around the region to come in and enjoy our festival.
And I definitely will be here on one of those days, if not both, because it sounds like such a wonderful experience. And for those of us to be able to do that, I had spent time many moons ago in Knoxville when I did my internship at the University of Tennessee Hospital, which was only, gosh, Jason, 50 years ago, so you can imagine what the differences I've observed indeed. In Knoxville have been. Uh-huh. But and then your next formal kind of production after that, what is that going to be?
Yeah, so this is our third title of the year. The first two have been the Masterwork Main Stage Tennessee Opera shows that we've done this season. So the third title we had is actually going to be at the Bijou Theater, which is a smaller theater just down the street from the Tennessee. It's a historic small theater. I think it has about 800 or so seats in it. And it's a charming little space. Difficult to produce opera in some ways because it's the pit is not very deep, so it's hard to get a professional orchestra to agree to play in the pit. And so it has some challenges. Back of house space, dressing rooms are very limited, bathrooms, all that for the artists. So it's a little bit of a challenging space, but the audience experience in a space like that is so reminiscent of those old, beautiful European opera houses. That sense of intimacy there, because you were acoustically, it was right, you were right there, and visually you were closer to the action. So it's a lovely space to present. So we're actually doing a new production of an unknown setting of Cinderella. It's in French, called Cendrillon, by this woman who, her name is Pauline Viardot. And she wrote this opera. She was French, obviously, and she wrote this opera in the late 1800s. And it's a charming play. It was actually written for a very small audience. I think it was even, they used to have these gatherings at people's homes, these salons. And it was like, I think, a salon piece originally that was eventually orchestrated into an orchestrated version of it. But it's just no one really paid much attention to it at the time. She was a female composer, so that was interesting. But she was also, her sister was a very famous opera singer, and actually she herself was a singer too. So they had developed their fame in other musical circles as well. But then just not long, a handful of years ago, the piece was resurrected by Wolf Trap Opera Company, and they did a production of this. It was very interesting. So we have taken elements from that production, and now we're doing our own version of this. We have a brand new written English dialogue interspersed with the French music. And then just, it's a very family-friendly show. It's about 90 minutes, under 90 minutes, I think it is. So it's great for families. So it's a way, a very accessible vehicle into an experience with opera, particularly, as I said, for families that want to come and see a Cinderella show. Everyone knows the story of Cinderella. And it's a take on that that I think is going to be very charming and fun and a great way to end the stage production season of our 23-24 season here.
Season, though, does July begin the next
exactly.
season?
Exactly. We're on the school year model. Yeah, so we're fall, winter, spring for our production season. And then summer's usually prep for the start again.
Yeah. Okay. And you mentioned, I think you do get the exposure to students in the schools in the area, which is good. So when you look at the number of folks who perform with Knoxville Opera Company, how many of those are you talking about?
Oh, gosh. It's funny. When
it varies.
Yeah. So when we're not in production, we have 6-8 people in the office at any given time from the staff. The day we begin production, we have 100, 150 people involved in a production. So you've got your chorus, which can be anywhere from, 2 to 3 dozen people generally. And of course, your orchestra can vary from 20 to 50, anywhere in that range. And then, of course, all your stage crew and the people that are designing and building the set. You've got your costume crew, wigs and makeup people. So you put on this massive production that's obviously not seen on stage, but all these things go into that. Your lighting designers, they have got to light the show. And so all those elements come in, and in about 20, the artists show up knowing their music about 21 to 23 days before we perform it. And then we put it all together in that 3 weeks time. And it's fast and furious and expensive. So we want to get it done as quickly as we can. And we usually get there. It's pretty exciting when it all comes together at the end.
Oh, my goodness. I've been a part of small productions in Athens at our local art center, and it's a minimum of 6 weeks to 8 weeks of rehearsals. Mm-hmm. We could never do anything in 3 weeks.
Yeah, I mean, and the scale of it, too.
And the scale. You've got this monstrous scale here, absolutely. So you do have, obviously, the performers or the singers, some are coming from elsewhere, right?
That's correct.
Do you go and get these folks to come here? Do you have somebody that does all that for you, I guess?
Yes.
So, that'd be a crazy
question. Yeah, no, it's a great question. A lot of people ask because for the most part, our chorus, and we do small roles we can cast locally, but for the most part, the bigger roles, the principal artists, come from out of town. So we, through a series of things, it could be reputation, it could be, so word of mouth, it can be open auditions that we have, it could be networks that people we've worked with in the past. So I do have an artistic team here that helps me. We put this series of names together, and when we host auditions, we have debriefs afterwards to see who might be a candidate for any opera, whether we may love an artist but not yet have a show for them, but we'll keep them in mind for something 3 years down the road when a particular kind of show comes along. Yeah, so we know the agents, the managers that are out there, the non-managed singers, all of these people. We get information all the time from artists submitting their materials, but yeah, we host auditions every year, and then we just figure out how to get the right mix of a cast together that works for each show.
So as an example, if I'm a singer that's been around a long time, but I live in New York, mm-hmm. and I know you're about to present in so many weeks or whatever, a production, I could then submit, or I have to come and audition. I can't just walk in and say, Jason, I've been in all these things,
right.
You're going to let me sing.
Exactly.
That doesn't work.
Yeah, it doesn't work that way quite. And so generally, right now our timing is about anywhere from 12 to 18 months before the production. We'll send out the offers for the folks. Again, I might hear someone multiple times before actually casting them in something. And you can see growth in people. The idea, being a regional opera company, we're not the Metropolitan Opera or Chicago or Houston. So those are they're going to get those sort of seasoned artists that are world famous. And that's what we want to be, is that company, like the minor leagues for those folks ready to hit the majors, that you're catching them right on the cusp of a major career. We want to catch them right before, and identifying that talent and giving them their first major performance of this role, that role, whatever, and that they can then take to those bigger houses. Occasionally we do get, like in the case of La Traviata, our principal artist for that, the Violetta, is a regular. She sings at the Met, and she had a gap in her time schedule, and I've known her a very long time, and we called in some favors to get her here, and she came and just carried the production to an entirely new level than what we've done. So my team is very well connected in this industry, so we are getting to punch way above our weight class here in Knoxville, Tennessee right now.
That's awesome. Are you allowed to reveal anything on the horizon for our listeners now, or I don't want you to say anything?
Sure. I will say that we do have one more concert that we'll be pushing at the end of this season. So we don't typically do this, but we're in partnership with a convention that's going to be in town. It's called the National Association of Teachers of Singing. We are co-presenting a tenor in performance at the Tennessee Theater, a one-night-only performance at the end of June. And his name is Lawrence Brownlee, arguably one of the world's greatest tenors today. He's African-American, just great colleague, artist, musician, and he's going to come and going to knock people's socks off with that voice. So he's, since Pavarotti was here in the 80s and sang at Thompson Bowling Arena, just the biggest opera star to set foot in East Tennessee to perform here. So that is going to be really exciting. It'll be a sellout at the Tennessee for that show. And then, we set our sights after that to next season. And we'll probably be able to announce our season just this spring. We'll be able to announce it. But it will be, again, so it'll be something light and comic, another tragic opera, and then probably another contemporary chamber show. So we're finalizing those details as we speak.
Your audiences, since you've been here, or even in your career elsewhere, what do they seem the majority to like? Do they like the tragedies, the comedies?
It really depends, because you'll get, for instance, we've had the conversation just recently, and as we're talking about future season planning, Gilbert and Sullivan, Gilbert and Sullivan, they write operettas, light, fluffy, silly, British humor kind of stuff. And there are just avid fans of Gilbert and Sullivan. So people will look and see if there's a production happening within 4 hours of their home, they'll make the trip to see it. So something like that just has a very specific fan base, draws a lot of people. So it's a pretty good box office bet that it'll be a good turnout, because People love GNS. There are the ABCs of opera, the Aida, Bohems, and Carmens. You know, the really the mainstay operas that are these bucket list type shows that people want to see time and time again. And so those obviously have to stay in the sort of regular rotation for companies. Aida is a big scale production that we have done in the past, but it's very expensive to do and certainly not on our short-term plans at all. But yeah, these common titles that do draw those kind of crowds, and those tragic, what people imagine is opera where the soprano dies at the end, those sort of things, right? They are tried and true war horses because they have proved time and time again that they, no matter the generation, continue to move people because they tell these universally human stories of love and heartbreak or love lost or war, battles, and just you find very raw and very human emotions in these pieces, which is why people continue to be gravitating towards them after all these years.
I want to know how you as a singer and how these fantastic folks on stage can lay flat on their back and don't even need a microphone to project into a 2,000-seat auditorium. How do they do that?
Yeah, it's the human body is a really tremendous, amazing thing. Somebody centuries ago figured out how you could project your voice without going hoarse over all that. But it's a very specific vocal technique that allows them to just basically, so long as they keep in alignment with their sort of waist up, the diaphragmatic breathing, and just making sure that they can keep the tension out of their neck and all that, that they could either standing straight up and down or lying flat on their backs and angles in between could keep their posture in a way that can still project sound the way that they do. They train like marathon runners. And it is an extraordinary feat to see someone.
And you can appreciate, as a physician, I'm just trying to sit there and say, wait a minute. Taking care of folks with a lot of things over the years, and I'm realizing, whoa, this is phenomenal. None of us without training or, like you say, this other, but just wonderful. And the young lady that did play the lead in that, just, oh, my goodness. But all of them are just awesome.
Yeah.
Now, where can folks, Jason, actually contribute to the Knoxville Opera Company? Do you have an address, an email type thing they can contribute?
Sure. I mean, our website is a gateway to a lot of stuff, so it's easy, knoxvilleopera.org. .org. That's the easiest way to find us. Of course, we are on all the social media platforms, so all you have to do is look us up, Google us. You will find everything you need to know about us. Yeah. And what I would encourage folks is, you know, we want to build the relationship with you. So we want to make sure you come and have a good experience with us, and then take that journey with us. If the first thing you came and you thought, I can appreciate what they did, but maybe it's not my thing, give another one a chance, because you might find your thing eventually, or you may just love it all. We certainly have omnivores who just crave everything we do, and others that find themselves very specific needs. But it's what I encourage a lot of people, this sort of step outside of your comfort zone and do something. Everybody should do certain things in life, should go to an art museum, even if they don't have a background in art history, and just look and try to figure out and have someone talk to them about the strokes of the brush or whatever, or if it's abstract, or how are they telling that story on canvas, or to learn to appreciate landscapes and architecture. And with music and opera specifically, it's just the more you invest in it, there's just so much to be gained and get out of it. And we are storytellers at our very core. And that I say so often, because it's really the stories that connect us. It became our tagline even. And we're giving voice to stories that connect us. And in a time when there's so much attention focused on what makes us different and the challenges we have, it's certainly a welcome change when we find opportunities to sit elbow to elbow with our neighbors. And it doesn't matter who my neighbor voted for or what their background is or whatever. We are sitting here watching a shared human story come to life and feeling empathetic impulses that we need to do more of in this world. So it's, I encourage people to just come and check it out. And I think, of course, we love their support, their advocacy. We, more than anything, we want to make a difference in this world. So if you can't afford a donation, our tickets start at $25. We want to be a part of your journey nonetheless. And we are a civic asset that we want to be available to everybody. We comp tickets to every student that wants a ticket as we are able. And I think for La Traviata, we gave away, I think, almost 300 tickets to students. We want to break those barriers down. And there are people who support those kind of efforts and see the value in that. And there's so many ways to get involved. But the first thing I would say, come and see what we do. And let's start the relationship. I'd love to start that journey with anybody.
Absolutely. Very well said. And do you have a favorite opera?
As a singer, I always said whatever opera I was doing at the time, because it was what I was most focused on. And my kids and family would just hearing me listening to the same thing over and over, because I'm just reminding myself or thinking of it. Like, oh, man, when are you going to get the next show? Because here we are. How many times am I going to listen to Marriage of Figaro? But I say Marriage of Figaro. That was the one I probably sang the most in my career. And it's probably one of the most perfect operas in the world. I also do have a soft spot for Puccini operas, the Bohème, La Bohème's of the world, that sort of thing. And Verdi operas, there's not a Verdi opera I won't enjoy, mostly because I could never, my voice was never big enough to sing the huge Verdi opera stuff. So I have envy for what those singers can do just from a sound production standpoint, but the power of those sounds as well. I've never seen Otello live before, but Verdi's Otello is one of those great masterpieces. But La Traviata was one of Verdi's great masterpieces, so you got to see one of his. But yeah, there's a lot of great stuff out there, but I'm the omnivore that enjoys many things.
On the horizon in the opera world, you're mentioning this gentleman. Are there three or four that our listeners can maybe go and Google and listen to get a sense of how good they are? I mean, who, in your opinion, would be some of the, I guess, the big folks?
Yeah, you know, another great question. And with technology being what it is, too, it's such a great thing, too. And in fact, I guess just to demonstrate the caliber of the kind of artists that we have singing here, I think the best way to start is we typically link on our webpage. Mm-hmm. We have links to the singers, the artists that are coming to sing for us. And their webpages often have lots of video content and audio stuff. So you can hear the kind of artists that are doing it now and who are coming here. And you think, this is world-class talent that we're getting here in Knoxville, Tennessee. So even starting there, getting a familiarity with their personal stories, their artistic journeys, and the fact that we are a part of that here, helps build an identity to that. That it's like our home team a little bit. Like, hey, that person came through Knoxville, and now look where they are today. This company's been part of many stories over the decades.
Oh, it's awesome. And this is a question I ask my guests a lot, and I'm not sure how we started with this as many episodes ago. College junior comes to Jason and says, I would like to consider a career going forward in opera. Okay? How do you, as a performer, now as an administrator, part-time performing for fun, what do you say to that college student, the good things to look at, maybe some things they need to be aware of that could have a little negative impact on what they're doing? How do you sit and talk to that particular student at that age, 20, 21 years old?
Yeah. Depending how close I am and how candid I can be with this person, because
be candid.
It is... You know, it is a very hard thing to do. I mean, if you want to be a pitcher in the major leagues, you got to have a certain velocity. If you want to be in the NBA, you got to probably be a certain height, and you've got to be able to shoot at a pretty good percentage clip. So there are just the basics of, do you have the size, voice, the instrument that could carry you to one of the major stages in? And there are various tiers. You could sing in the opera choruses for stuff, or you could sing on the biggest stages in the world and everywhere in between. But really, when talking to a junior, and it is a business like any other, and particularly when you're doing this, there's no handouts that happen in this. You've got to be scrappy, and you've got to be very entrepreneurial. You've got to be your own manager for the first many years of your career. So you've got to hustle. You've got to have your packet ready. You've got to be so polished and prepared when you get the opportunity to audition for a company. All this back work needs to happen well in advance of that. So if your languages aren't strong, I encourage folks, if you're going to opera, you got to learn languages. I worked in 7 languages over the course of my career. I don't speak fluently in 7 languages, but if I'm going to learn something that's in Russian, I need to know what every word says and I need to know how to pronounce every word. And if I'm doing a role, I'm going to have to learn what everybody else is saying in Russian as well. So at the very base, get your Italian, get your German, get your French, get those 3 basic ones. Take whatever you need. You do an immersive program, whatever. Build that foundation. Kids today, and I say kids today, like I'm an old guy, but it seems like kids of every, as I get older, I realize every generation says this about kids today, but young folk these days. But I find a real lack of curiosity in some of the kids. And by that, not that they're not interested in lots of things, but to take things, to take the initiative to go deep in something. Mm-hmm. I was guilty of being interested and getting involved in a lot of things. I played a lot of sports, but I wasn't great at any of them, right? So I didn't stick to one and said, this is the one I'm going to be great at. With a discipline like this, if I want to be a concert pianist, a concert violinist, if I want to be a professional basketball player, whatever it is I want to do, I need to give that the 10,000 hours to virtuosity, right? I need to give it the time, because just because I have a pretty singing voice is only going to take me so far, because that's God-given, right? If I have a pretty voice, like that comes out of the package that way, but it's what I do with that and how am I learning the craft, because it's also acting, it's singing. It's putting it all together. It's language. It's storytelling. It's art and history and the context of, if you're doing a period piece, understanding how men and women dressed, how they walked, how they presented their calves. It's just like the little details like that. But that sense of curiosity that if I'm in an undergrad program and say I'm even in a voice program, I see this all the time where students aren't going to see their colleagues in recital and in performances because they're busy with their other stuff. They got their own things going. But like, what better way, A, to learn new and more repertoire, but also support your colleagues. But if you're not curious and hungry to learn more repertoire, to learn more, like that should be innate in what you do, because you have to love this with such a passion that you've got to deal with a lot of rejection. Because for every, the odds are not with you when it comes to auditions. Even in I had a very good ratio, and I'd say probably for every 10 auditions I did, I might have gotten 2 or 3 gigs. And that's a very high percentage relative to speaking. But again, I had the advantage of being a hardworking young bass that, you know, had this, I was always pretty entrepreneurial, and I was a hustler, and I would get in front of people. And if I got hired, I was the best prepared person in there. And I took instructions well. So, yeah, it's being eager to learn, not saying that I have this great voice, you need to hire me, but really taking this approach like the beautiful opportunity it is that you've been given this gift, this talent. And if you give it your all to be your best in that, opportunities will come in one fashion or other. We are called to do things with our hands, our voices, our bodies, our minds, whatever that is. And if we live into our calling in life, like I said, if you have a God-given gift and you are living into that, the opportunities will present themselves in the way that you will make a difference in this world. And I was privileged that it got to be through singing. Because I thought I was going to be an investment banker and make my impact by being a philanthropist or something, because I was going to be so rich. But that was not the path for me. And in fact, it was a much more humble and humbling experience, where there's nothing more vulnerable that I had ever experienced than standing up with nothing between me and a panel of judges or a panel of people I'm auditioning for and sing a song for them without a costume, nothing but me. And it's just, it feels very naked and raw. And it can also be very beautiful to sit in that vulnerability and allowing yourself also to make yourself vulnerable. As an artist, you're going to explore so many deep and wonderful things, but there's a few things there: work ethic, entrepreneurial spirit, ability to be vulnerable, not think you've got all the answers. But you could say that about just about any junior in any discipline. I probably couldn't.
But that's excellent advice. I like that, living into our calling. And then the aside that I always ask people, because I'm a harmonica player, when can I play with the Knoxville Opera Company? As a harmonica player.
As a harmonica player. As soon as we have an orchestration with a harmonica player in it, we'll post the auditions and I'm going to send it to you.
I still have to audition. Thanks a lot.
Yeah. There are a lot of harmonica players out there in East Tennessee that want a piece of that pie. I'm sure.
No, it was really funny. The Knoxville Symphony brought a smaller set to Athens a few years back, and my friends were goading me into talking to the director after it was over and said, why don't you just go ask him? And I said, you know exactly what he's going to say, but I don't mind. I'll talk a post in the ground. But I did, and he looked at me very calmly, and he stroked his chin, and he said the same answer you gave. As soon as we come up with something symphonic that might use a harmonica, but it's just the beauty of what you have done and brought here in your time with Knoxville Opera. And I can guarantee you, I will be back. Gail will be back. And let me say, folks, something that really impressed me about Jason. When we came to the performance of La Traviata, he had notes that had been taped to the folks purchasing tickets with a handwritten note thanking them for being here. I'm impressed with that. That seems, just from talking to you for this period of time, like someone that you would be enjoying having the people here. Mm-hmm. But I was pretty impressed. Wow. I've attended a lot of shows at all levels, the Fox Theater and everywhere else. Never have I seen something that said thank you for being here with their name on it. So kudos to you for doing that. Yeah. That was very impressive.
Well, thank you. It's a lot of work writing a lot of notes, but it has such a payoff, because particularly if it's a first-time attendee, if I can figure that out and match them to their name or whatever it is, I write hundreds and hundreds of notes a year to put on people's seats, and it's a joy to do. And thank you for saying that. I really appreciate it.
That was just awesome and greatly appreciated. But thank you so much for being here. And, folks, let me reemphasize, here on April 2021, the Rossini Festival in Knoxville, Market Square, and all down through the various areas. Sounds like a wonderful thing to be. And then please look up the KnoxvilleOpera.org and join, subscribe, come to one of these wonderful shows. And I look forward, certainly, Jason, to seeing you again in the future at these performances. But thank you so much for being with us.
It was a real joy. Thanks for taking the time to be with me.
Great. And folks, as I say to each and every one of you all who are listening in, have a safe and healthy day, and I'll see you a little further up the road.